We have been talking about this morning the path that leads to the cessation and how the teachings of the Buddha are brought down into two very straightforward approaches known as the two crucial principles of Buddha Dharma that then become the path of practice. Of course, within the Hinayana teachings and the Mahayana teachings, there's a variety of many different parts of practices or ways of practices, modes of practices. But primarily, all of them come down into the Eightfold Noble Path. And then when we meet challenges of not being able to fully embody the Eightfold Noble Path, where the thought is distracted, where the speech becomes unvirtuous, where the physical actions begin to also go into more creations of neurosis rather than creations of goodness, where the livelihood itself is very adverse to the view of compassion, where mindfulness and concentration are missing, where the diligence becomes distracted and disturbed. So when the challenges of embodying these Eightfold Paths come about, this gives us a better perspective into what the Buddha meant when he talked about ignorance as the cause of suffering. So at such a point, a meditator's understanding of ignorance doesn't become this object called the enemy ignorance, but rather one sees the permeating dominance of ignorance on every perspective that we have. So essentially what we are saying is that each of the perceptions that we have are so contaminated by a wrong perception. Each of the perceptions that we have are held within a wrong view. And the wrong view is the mistaken understanding of the nature of reality. Do we understand phenomena, outer phenomena, as it actually is? Or do we look at it with a view of what the ego would like it to be? Do we give phenomena the freedom to be what it is? Or do we look at phenomena, capturing them in the confines of expectation and demand of an ego-cherishing attitude? So where the ego-cherishing attitude adds a flavor and taints what is perception, then that is what makes it wrong perception, wrong view, not understanding it for what it is, but imposing upon it your own demands of what you might want it to be. So where that tendency is predominant, then that is the subjugation of the mind by the ego, by the ignorance. So that then leads to causes. Wherever such a demand of the ego is met, there is more craving, there is more demand, unceasing demand continuously is there. That's how the hunger for things to remain as I would like it to be increases. Unaccommodating, uncompromising, rigidity in the attitude becomes the resultant state. Wherever such a demand of the ego is not met, then the sort of the antagonism or the anger aggressive response to what you think is interfering your expectations and demands begins to be very dominant. And so aggressiveness, impatience, irritability, discouragement, sadness, and all different kinds of suffering that we create primarily for our own self are the resultant outcome of where the demands have not been made. Since the struggle between making sure that the demands of the ego are met, that the phenomena responds to your demands, the ego's demands, and the preoccupation with making sure it happens, and the apprehension that it might not be so, does come out, where the mind does get tired of this tension that it has to retain. Wherever the tension is so strong, then the sort of the reactive impulse is to try and live in denial. Wherever we have the ability, the energy to concentrate on getting something, acquiring something, wherever we have the energy and the concentration to making sure nothing goes wrong, is an energy that we have, we do that. So part of our existence is concentrated in the divesting of these two energies, obtaining and making sure that whatever impedes that is being properly dealt with. And that's what we call aggressiveness. And so sense of aggression, sense of attachment, and trying to be desireful, making sure that that what you are desireful is obtained. The preoccupation with this is tiring. It is exhausting. And since it is exhausting and tiring, whatever little time we can get, we are so exhausted we don't even want to think about it. It's like putting off a certain thing for tomorrow or any other day because you're physically exhausted and doing something. It is in the same way that the mind becomes exhausted of constant craving and grasping, self-grasping, constant aggression, anxiousness, sort of the tension and the apprehensions. And so major part of anything else is blocked out by a mind that sustains what is called neutral state. But neutral state is a passive, aggressive state. The main characteristics of a neutral, sort of an indifferent attitude is aggression, laziness, and an unsatiating sort of a mind that is nothing but discontent. So you could say it is aggressive, it is lazy, it is constantly discontent. So where these three are breeding in one's own mind, although it looks like a state of no thought, but nevertheless, it holds on. It's a state of absolute denial that allows you to go beyond that stubbornness. It does nothing. That neutral state does nothing. The indifferent state does nothing in terms of destroying desire. It does nothing in terms of destroying apprehension and aggression. And it does nothing in terms of destroying laziness, dullness of the mind. So when the full preoccupation of our concentration is embroiled in these different kinds of creations of our own mind, that is called mistaken perception, wrong view. So where this is not understood, then we find that it is very difficult, even engaging in the Eightfold Path or 37 practices of the Bodhisattva, condensed into simply the six paramitas, for example, being generous, being patient, being effortful or diligent, being ethically correct in one's own conduct, practicing of equanimity, maintaining a balance of mindfulness, equilibrium of mindfulness, and the generation of prajna wisdom. All the wonderful qualities of the Mahayana path of the practices become very superficial. And they become superficial because they do not have the strength to cut through the deceptiveness of wrong concepts, wrong view. So therefore, the Buddha's teachings are, if we can use the word, designed in such a way that the view of the Four Noble Truths, if understood accurately, then can lead a person to engaging in the path of the practices, such as the embodiment of the Eightfold Path or the 37 practices. But through that engagement, complete challenge arises that requires your perspective and your relationship to phenomenal world to go through the change, to go through a transition. So there is no, for example, Buddhist teachings also talk about Buddha fields. And so if you say, where is a Buddha field? Buddha field is based upon your perceptions. This is going to be samsara as long as the perception is going to be samsaric. Where the samsaric perceptions itself fall apart, whatever good is left, if you wish to call it Buddha field, then that is what is Buddha field. So we have remarkable examples of great teachers, one of the wonderful stories of Dokkenzei Eshdoje, I think I've heard from my teachers, is when he walked into any place, he would often prostrate on all four directions. Because every time people would ask, why are you doing this? He would say, I cannot look at any direction and not see Buddhas and Bodhisattvas everywhere. Whatever I look at is pure field. And so did we miss something? Isn't it? We may be among all Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, but yet we'd still be a sort of sangha of paranoia amidst all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So then immediately we'd say, okay, who's your favorite Buddha? Which Bodhisattva do you connect to more? You know, that's immediately how we would approach. It's because our mind is so predominant in a perception that goes more by what it senses, likes, dislikes, feels like, wants, expects, demands. And so therefore, the natural approachability, sort of the expansive naturalness of relating to everything is very changed in a mind that doesn't overcome this wrong view. And so therefore, part of the practice, all of that what we engage upon, is a very skillful method of bringing that about. Now, unfortunately, when meditators miss that point, then this is, as I said this morning, where you miss the view in meditation. Then you might be meditating correctly. But if you miss this crucial view of the Four Noble Truths that the Buddha is trying to impart in his 45 years of teaching, then we have the shell of the practice. But the shell of the practice doesn't let the mind go through the processes. And so the actual benefit that should come about doesn't happen. So therefore, whatever, even a single mantra that you might do, even a single moment of sitting that you might do, even one understanding of the teachings that you might have, but if it is connected to the right view, then in that way you can actually go through a transition, because that view allows you to go deeper into understanding the truth as is expounded, as is the main emphasis expounded within the teachings of the Buddha himself. Being able to recognize the view and then engaging on the path of the practices, as we stopped this morning, is then said to be the two path of refuge and bodhisattvahood. Now, keeping that, what we just spoke about, in mind, in the text it says, unless of the two, the refuge is the first. And so unless an individual has a good foundation of refuge, it is extremely difficult for that individual to have even a high level of bodhicitta or altruism in one's own mind. Can a person without refuge generate bodhicitta? Is the question. Answer according to what I've just said is no. Now, many people, of course, we like to be very sort of accommodating. And so in that way, outside of this retreat, if somebody asks me, can one be a kind person or develop bodhicitta, not kindness, but bodhicitta, without being a Buddhist? My polite answer is always yes. In the retreat, no. Why so? Is because you have to understand what bodhicitta is. If you understand bodhicitta as an emotional kindness that is sympathetic towards the others, yes. Such a kindness that is more on the level of emotional can be generated by all human beings. However, for bodhicitta, and that is then the true enlightened mind that understands the true nature of reality of the phenomena, such an understanding to arise without depending upon refuge is absolutely impossible. However, you need to understand what refuge is. Three times repeating, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dhamma, I take refuge in the Sangha. Does that do the trick? No, that's not the refuge we are talking about. Refuge we are talking about is where the mind has let go of self-grasping. Not because of a religion, not because of a vow, not because of a teacher, not by association with a spiritual belief, but because of the true nature of inner and outer phenomena realized. A thorough understanding of the true nature of reality, generating a consequent resultant realization that there is nothing to grasp. A natural disintegration of self-cherishing attitude. That is then a mind truly having taken refuge. Such a refuge is the only way through which genuine bodhicitta can arise. So is that understood? Is that clear? So here also it says, from the Buddhist point of view, now to go, this is the short version, now the commentary version. From the Buddhist point of view, the demarcation between a practicing Buddhist and a non-practicing Buddhist is made by whether a person has taken refuge or not taken refuge. When we speak about refuge, we are talking about taking refuge into three jewels, as they are called, three ratna, if it is referred to as the three jewels. Tibetan term is kunchoksum, which is not three jewels, but it is the three rare and sublime ones. So when we take refuge into Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, they are referred to as the three jewels because they are rare, because they are unsurpassable in their qualities, they are sublime in their own nature. Point here that one is making, here it says, is that the notion of taking refuge involves a ceremony, but it is not only the ceremony or simply participating in a ceremony of refuge, formal refuge ceremony, by which one is designated to have becoming a Buddhist or not. So, for example, it is true. Yeah. Even if you have taken formal refuge vows, but if your mind still has doubts and hesitations, and in that moment of hesitation and doubt regarding the validity of the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, such as when you fall sick and very discouraged and hopeless, if your mind seeks refuge into the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, then there is refuge. There's an essence of refuge. But if you depend more on your own state of paranoia and you hang on to that much more, then there is no surrenderance to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. Here, the validity of the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, you have not criticized it. You have not been critical about it. But nevertheless, it does not in any way show a significant trust in the power, in the wisdom, in the truth of the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. However, here it says, if one truly realizes the true qualities of the three jewels and sees them as an absolute source of refuge, then even if a person hasn't been through a formality of refuge, such a person may have better strengthened refuge than one who has gone through the formalities of a ceremony. So ultimately, it's your mind. So if I say, how many of you have you taken refuge in various traditions? By virtue of your having done the morning session, you've taken refuge, isn't it? But at the same time, in your own mind, the observation must be is, have you taken sincere refuge? A refuge that is able to look at Buddha, the truth of the Buddha, the truth of the Dhamma, the truth of the Sangha, more. And in that refuge and the surrenderance of the refuge. Now, surrenderance has to be understood. It's not simply sort of body, speech, and mind giving. That's not surrenderance. Many people think that that is surrenderance. Surrenderance means what brings in your mindfulness more strongly. That's surrenderance. If your awareness surrenders to the wisdom of the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha more strongly, that is surrendering to the three jewels. If your body, speech, and mind surrenders more to distraction, then that is lack of surrenderance, lack of devotion. So whom do you trust more? And especially in a panic-stricken moment, whom do you trust more? Does, oh, Buddha come into your mind more? Or, oh, poor me comes into your mind more? Does the anger become predominant? The redness of the anger just pervades everywhere? Or does the calming sense of truth of the Dhamma and the reality of their own true empty nature is predominant? Big selfishness dissolves. Do you pop it with, it's inherently empty in nature, it's just a mere thought? That's refuge. Or, yes, my past and my present, and he did that and she did that, and what would be the consequences of my future, and how could I gain from that? The long storyline, is that what you then give more strength to? Then that's refuge in samsara. There's no sign of refuge here at all. Where there is no such sign of a refuge, do you really honestly think bodhicitta will arise in that mind? Bodhicitta will be, as I said yesterday, an etc. that you do after you've done everything for yourself. You know, when we have a plate full of food, and then we eat that, and then all the leftover that is left, and we look around and we see a small bird or some animal, and then you give. Or the meat that we eat off the bone, or the, what do you call that? Meat, yes. And then the bone that is left, then we endearingly give a dog. And we say, bone is healthy for you, meat is not. Or something like that. So those are sort of all the useless things that then we don't have anything else to do. Then if that is the same thing that is done to bodhicitta, self, 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 self. Everything thought is for self. Everything said is for self. Everything acted upon is for self. Towards the end of the day, 10 minutes. Kind of a bored way of expressing kindness. May everyone have happiness. May they not meet with suffering. I take joy in their accomplishment. And then I rest in equanimity. And that's, again, back to your personal self. If that kind of an attitude is, and that is predominant in how we practice the Dharma, such as even each word that one hears, one is trying to actually see how the self can gain from that. Each meditation we do, there's a tremendous amount of the self's agenda in that meditation also. And so where that is predominant, surrenderance in completeness to the wisdom of the Dharma, to the truth of the Buddha, to the truth of the Sangha is not evident. So that is lacking in refuge. And therefore here it says, first thing is to examine one's essence of refuge. Confidence, whether the refuge is the basis of one's confidence in the truth and the aspiration of realizing the truth. Is refuge the object of support when the mind is distracted or disturbed by outer distractions and inner absorption? Is refuge true confidence of things as they truly are? And therefore, to understand refuge correctly is important. But for refuge to be understood correctly, you would have to relate to the three jewels. You'd have to have enough trust in the Buddha, you'd have to have enough trust in the Dharma, and you'd have to have enough trust such that these trusts become confidence, it becomes the object of support, it becomes a source into which you can unhesitatingly take refuge into, surrender into. And therefore, can the Buddha be trusted? On what basis would you trust the Buddha? You could trust the Buddha on the basis only of knowing what the Buddha embodies, who the Buddha is. And so Lojin Dharmashri says, for every person who takes refuge, crucial question that must be asked is, do you know that you can trust the Buddha? How would you place the confidence on the Buddha? Who is the Buddha? What makes a Buddha? Generally, when we speak about the Buddha, we talk about Shakyamuni Buddha, 2,500 years ago, the historical Buddha who lived in India, attained enlightenment, and so on and so forth. And so, into the enlightened mind of such a Buddha, one takes refuge. That is also true. But from the Mahayana's perspective, one does not only refer to a single Buddha. Therefore, all Mahayana texts supplicate to Buddhas of the past, present, and the future. So it is not a singular expression, it is a plural expression. So it's not just one, but based upon a sense of knowing the embodiment of truth that can manifest in many diverse ways. And into all those who have walked this path and attained that absolute truth, the realization, one refers to them as the Buddhas. And therefore, in some ways, when we say, I take refuge into the Buddha, from a Mahayana perspective, you're taking refuge into all the Buddhas of the past, present, and the future. So here, however, the key factor, again, as the teachings say, now, how does all Buddhas evolve? How can you validate that these Buddhas, or what we call the Buddhas, are an object of total surrenderance? And so here, again, it is said, Buddha cannot be an object of absolute surrenderance if one doesn't, in one's own mind, understand the qualities of the Buddha. So it is not so much the form Buddha that one takes refuge into, but into the qualities of the Buddha, or those who are the Buddha. And so if we look at the qualities of the Buddha, one would then see that Buddha originates from Dhamma. And so here it says, the key lies in understanding the nature of Buddha in order for a person to have unhesitating surrenderance into the Buddha. So Dhamma is what then truly is the most absolute fundamental core essence. When the Dhamma is actually understood, then we have a Sangha who engages and practices in what the Dhamma is imparting. From among the Sangha, there are those who obtain an absolute realization, and therefore they are the Buddhas. So the origin of Buddha is the Sangha. Origin of the Sangha is the Dhamma. And so when we think about, can we trust the three jewels, rather than emphasizing the form of the Buddha into whom one takes refuge, the first key factor is looking at the wisdom of Dhamma, your own analysis, your own deepened insight of the truth of the wisdom further enhances your mind's capacity to see the wisdom in the teachings, the truth in the teachings. That essence understood also makes one appreciate the body of the assembly, the Sangha, who engages and practices, and therefore they become an object of veneration. But an exceptional being among those in the assembly, the Sangha, are those who then fully realize, fully obtain the enlightened state, the sort of understanding of the truth of the Dhamma, and therefore that is the Buddha. So then the quality of the Buddha is then manifest as realization of the truth, which is the Dhamma, that which is then on the path engaged by the Sangha. And therefore, one can see how the reference of a realized example, the reference of the truth of the wisdom of the teachings, and the reference of like sort of people who are on the same path, who are embodying the teachings faithfully, completely, are then support for a mind that at this moment requires the confidence, requires the support of being free from distractions and disturbances. And so therefore, taking refuge fortifies or strengthens one's determination, makes more strong one's approach to the path of the practices. But of this, one also then realizes one of the most important things is you yourself who need to become the Buddha. Therefore, cannot become the Buddha if you do not become the Sangha. And you cannot become the Sangha if you do not know the Dharma. Therefore, that whole plan that you have of liberating all sentient beings from suffering is going to depend upon your being a Sangha of practitioners. And your being a Sangha of practitioners is never going to be possible if you don't know the Dharma. And so, prior to liberating all beings, understanding the Dharma becomes important. Where the Dharma is not understood, then yes, it's a good plan, as we have many plans. There's, you know, a few of our residents. I think not everybody, not every time, but many times, and not only residents here, but there are some other Sangha members also that I know, good friends of mine, who never fail to buy a lottery. When is it? Every Monday or every Friday? When is it? That lotto. Don't pretend you don't know. I know you all buy. When is it? When do you buy a lotto? Friday, mostly Fridays. It's the closest. Tuesday. Now, they all do it with a good intention. So they all say, oh, when I win, it's all for you, the lotus garden, the pay the mortgage, pay off the debts, build the shrine room, you know, all of those good reasons that are there. So sometimes I find that very sweet. The karma of Buddhist practitioners is we never win lottery. Yeah. I've almost never heard, except one instance. That was also a small amount. However, the analogy that I'm using over here is our aspiration to liberate all sentient beings. It's quite like the lotto. Never impossible, but very difficult. We're going to benefit all sentient beings. We're going to subjugate all the negative emotions. We're going to free people from suffering and bring about the cessation of suffering. It's all good intentioned. But if the good intention is not founded upon good foundation, and as a Sangha, there is no embodying the Dharma, and as a practitioner, there is no understanding the Dharma, then since the cause itself is absent, how can a resultant state be produced? If everything is dependent upon a cause, then for every fruition to actually be there, manifest, cause is very important. And therefore, here it says, when speaking about being able to bring about cessation of suffering, or developing any goodness, even your own enlightenment, understanding Dharma is absolutely essential. To be able to understand Dharma, the second jewel, one must understand the predominant or the very fundamental two aspects of the Dharma. So when we say, I am practicing the Dharma, you must know that the Dharma that you practice must be engaged in these two aspects. First is, one, that is the path that leads to cessation. Dharma must be, number one, a path that leads to cessation. That is called path dharma, or dharma as a path. Second aspect of the dharma is the other, which is the cessation of all afflictions, which is called fruition dharma or resultant dharma. Dharma must have the characteristic or the quality of bringing about cessation of all afflictions. Now look very carefully, especially many of you speak against spiritual materialism. If I say, do you like spiritual materialism? Nobody likes spiritual materialism. However, spiritual materialism will be easy to bring in. Degeneration of the path of the practice of Dharma will happen if these two qualities are missing in what you are doing. Everything that you are doing as practice must be that which leads to cessation of the causes, and primarily that's the ignorance. The ignorance, cessation of the ignorance must be apparent. Anything that breeds ignorance and ego is not Dharma, including meditation, recitation, visualization, all the Vajrayana practices, Mahayana practices, and so on and so forth. You could be doing the best of the recitations, meditation, doing all the mechanical, technical things correctly. Right amount of visualization, right radiance, the lights go up in the right moment, they go down in the right moment, you rest in the adhishthana in the right moment, mantras are going clockwise, anti-clockwise, everything is fine. You're throwing yourself on the floor, that's very good. You're circumambulating the stupa, that's very good. You're ringing the bells at the right time, doing all the hung-hungs and the pet-pets, or sitting shamatha and being quiet, whatever it is. Everything could be technically correct, but if it is breeding ignorance, if it is still breeding ego grasping, then that wisdom that you hold is wisdom all right, but it does not have the penetrating ability, the means of cutting through causes that bring about suffering. So therefore, whatever you are engaged upon, from a simple method of resting the mind in simple meditation to any other kinds of diverse, complex kinds of meditation. Critically looking at your own practice to see how this, what I am engaging in, has the potency of cutting through deceptions of ego grasping and ignorance, must be clearly understood. Each day must disintegrate the stronghold of ego grasping. Each month's practice must make one's own ignorance and ego grasping, negative tendencies or kleshas, lessen and become weaker. Each year a significant transformation must happen in oneself that diffuses the stronghold of the same ego-cherishing attitude. In other words, each day as a practitioner, one must become kinder. One must have a much more relaxed attitude to everything that you are relating to. Each year that you progress on the path of the practice must bring about a person more able to be gentle, particularly in your relationship to the internal and the external phenomena. And therefore, the first aspect is that the Dhamma must be one that is a path that leads to the cessation. Second is, Dhamma must be that Dharma that one is practicing, must have the aspect of that which brings about cessation of affliction. That the, as the recedingness of the negativities happen, as the cessation of the ignorance continues to happen, like a moon that from day one to the full moon day, as the darkness recedes, the opposite whiteness or the luminosity, the clarity of the moon increases until it becomes a full moon. In the same way, just as the path of the Dhamma sort of weakens the affliction and the brings about the cessation of ignorance, likewise, a clarity of knowing things as they truly are must increase in your own mind. And so, just as much one is freeing oneself from the domination of ignorance and ego grasping, simultaneously the increase of knowledge, of knowing things as they truly are, must also take place in one's own mind. Just as ignorance recedes, wisdom must increase in one's own mind. So in your own aspect, in your own mind, whenever you practice, the question would be is how lessened are the negativities, the discursivenesses, and how more is your understanding of the reality of the natures of the things as they truly are. Today, when you look at things, has your perspective changed? When emotions arise very strongly in your own mind, even if one is not able to let go of the emotions completely, but has your interpretation of the emotion changed, gone through a remarkable, significant change? Simple as, if you were angry one day, 2 years ago, and you carried that anger for a week, have you done enough work with yourself that today you get angry and it lasts for an hour? That itself is a big change. It's 6 days and 23 hours of neurosis defeated. That's how one looks at it. Training the mind comes through that. It is for this that you practice the Dhamma. Otherwise, what's the use? Are we making time for somebody? Are we counting numbers for someone? Ultimately, whom are we going to go around and say, I did a million of that. I did so many hours of this. Moment of death, you're going to pack your suitcases with all the Dhamma books that you have read. And that weight of the suitcase, of all the suitcases of the Dhamma books, is somehow going to impress someone, we think. And we all know that's not going to happen. But we gauge that heaviness of the books to being sometimes more important than a transcendent mind, than a mind that has gone through transformation. Such is the mistake, such is what brings in spiritual materialism. Therefore, examining here, as it says, when we speak about Dhamma, it is very important to make a clear distinction of whether these aspects are present in what you are calling Dharma. If these aspects itself are missing, then what you are doing is not Dharma. It's something spiritual. It's a good posture. It's a good way to eliminate maybe doing more harm, but does not have the potential of bringing about an absolute cessation of all causes of suffering. In the same way, however, because one is referring to Dharma, one must also know the two other aspects of the Dharma, which is oral teachings of the Dharma. And so here it says, when we refer to the term Dharma, we may mean scriptural teachings and the realizations of the great enlightened masters and their transmissions, their teachings. This is then the sublime teaching of the Buddha, oral transmissions. At the same time, we also talk about Dhamma that is realized, that is understood. Understood and that which then has the ability to bring about cessation. Such is then said to be Tōgbi Chū, which is then realized Dharma. So there is the oral transmission of the teachings, which is the Dharma of transmissions. And then there is the realizing of the meaning, which is the realized Dharma or the Dharma of realization. And so both of these two are also terms related to the Dharma. We rely upon hearing the oral transmissions. We rely upon realizing the meaning of the Dharma. Both of these aspects also bring about the fruition of the previous two. So, however, we do know that, as I said, cessation of the afflictions, as well as the increase of the clear understanding of the nature of reality, are the two essential aspects that must be born out of both the latter two distinguishing factors that have been made. So the oral transmissions that you receive that are called Dharma must carry the first two aspects. Your own realization of the meaning of the Dharma must also bring about the first two aspects into one's own mind stream. So all the teachings that you hear must also increase the wisdom, the knowledge of things as they are. They must be powerful enough to subjugate and eliminate all the afflictions. Therefore, both of these, what is called path dharma and the resultant dharma, must be obtained as a result of relating to dharma through the oral transmissions as the dharma that you meditate and realize as your own meditative experiences. Now, if one thinks about these four things that we have talked about, which then comprise the word dharma. So when we say what is dharma, these are the four main distinct aspects that are spoken about. How can we then put that into practice? How can the dharma that we practice, the meditations that we do, for example, if you're sitting shamatha, how can your shamatha bring about the fruition of the first two aspects? How can it bring about cessation of afflictions? How can it increase the wisdom of knowing things as they truly are? This is then the core factor from where the Pratitya Samutapada, as is in Sanskrit, Patitya Samutapada, as is in Pali, Tenjing Drawar Chungwa, as is in Tibetan, referred to. Or in simple English, then it would be interdependent origination or codependent arising. Interdependent arising. All different ways to say the same thing. And so the Buddha's own teachings of interdependent origination are based so that it incorporates this what we have talked about. That the Dharma, in other words, if the Dharma and the practices that you do, whether it is hearing the teachings, whether it is meditatively experiencing the teachings, are able to produce the result of cessation of afflictions and the attainment of wisdom, can be brought about only if the permeating realization or the meaning of the Patitya Samudapada are understood in one's own life. If interdependent origination is understood, then whatever Dharma you are practicing has the power of bringing about cessation of afflictions and the attainment of the wisdom. Patitya Samuddhapada codependent arising teachings are simply based upon a single phrase spoken by the Buddha, where he says, whoever perceives the interdependent origination or dependent origination of reality sees the Dharma. So whoever sees interdependent origination sees the Dharma, and whoever sees the Dharma sees the Buddha, the Tathagata. So therefore, according to the Buddha's own teachings, one who sees interdependent origination clearly is the one who clearly understands what Dharma is. It is only through the clearly seeing of the Dharma in this way that a Buddha can actually originate. And therefore, the activities of the Buddha are going to be dependent upon such a realization of the Dharma. Now, the problem we have over here, of course, is we have our fruition more sort of planned out than the actual work. So it doesn't matter that we don't know much about interdependent origination. How many Buddhists are there today in the world who wouldn't even care to learn anything about karma, but are decidedly all planning towards liberating all sentient beings from samsara? So, you know, you have that game, connect the dots? Mm-hmm. You can't connect the dots here at all. One is headed the other way, the other is headed the other way. But still, since the heart is still with good intentions, therefore, there's a lot of sort of what I call picturesquely very cute Buddhists, all planning in this with good intentions. But the purpose, if really looked at, if one is absolutely honest with the approach of the practices, realistically speaking, how can one even imagine the accomplishment of such a profound fruition from a mind that is unable to think about smaller, very evident law of causality, where there is no awareness and mindfulness strong enough that actually impedes a negative action? But at the same time, the same mind seems to then be very, very sort of working hard at resting the mind in Buddha nature. So it's a kind of a discrepancy, contradiction that you can find at all times. You're trying to rest your mind in Buddha nature, emptiness, compassion, bodhicitta. But there's an absolute disregard to law of causality. Even today, some learned monks and nuns are beginning to say that. Even in the East, I've heard that. This is something I never heard before. But in the recent times, one or two very learned monks and nuns, one even with the title of a Kempo, actually saying, I don't believe in causality, law of causality, because who's seen it, or something like that. We come up with all those smart sort of statements. And so if one looks at it, karma to prove it is very easy. What you're experiencing now cannot be explained as happening without some degree of understanding of karma, isn't it? You're here, I'm here, we're doing this in this shed, imagining it to be a beautiful shrine room. It is. It is nice. Compared to what it was, it's very nice. But of all the people around the world that we had to meet today to do this, find it very difficult if it was sort of designated by a god or sent by some other forces. So causes and conditions lead you here. Various causes and conditions lead you here. So to think karma as causes and conditions that bring about the situation, it builds up situation, it dissolves situations to create more other diverse kinds of situations, that is then the law of causality that has to be understood. It's very easy to understand it in that way. I think karma is basically not understood when people think of it as more destiny. Then it's kind of difficult to say. It's unchangeable, it's solid, it is determined by some other powerful factor. That is difficult to understand or believe in. But sort of independent causes and conditions that come together. That, however, when not understood, the power of that interdependency, when that is not understood, then everything, subsequently everything that we do in Buddhist practices, as a Buddhist practice we try to manifest or keep in mind, becomes extremely difficult to bring to absolute fruition. And therefore here it says, seeing the words of the Buddha, whoever sees interdependent origination, then sees Dharma. Then one who sees Dharma in that way, cultivates the right view and the realization of which then results in the attainment of the Buddhahood. Here, therefore, Patitya-samudapada, which in English can simply be referred to as causal dependence or interdependent origination, Patitya, the word itself, simply meaning, in English, basically all translators seem to say causal dependence, Patitya. But in loose translation, if we could take some liberties with translation, means then because of this, that happens. So it is causal dependence. But when you say pratitya, you would simply go into because of this, because of certain thing. Samudapada, which is then by translators sort of translated as origination or referring to origination. However, again, taking a much more looser way to sort of look at what it means, evoking meaning of it, it seems to be what arises from or what originates from. Because of this, whatever originates. Because of this, this happens. Because of this, that happens. Pratitya Samudapada is simply that. So when we say understanding Pratitya Samudapada, understanding interdependent origination, what is interdependent origination? We're simply understanding this logic of knowing that the consequences of every situation is a resultant state originating from something else. So because of this, that happens. Because of something good, happiness happens. Because of something negatively done, suffering happens. That things do not happen randomly. Things do not happen by accident. Things do not happen because someone determines what they are going to do. But that there is a cause that is created, which then creates a situation, a consequent situation. Therefore, here it says the significance of the Pratitya-samudapada statement is that all conditioned things come into being as a result of causes and conditions. That there is nothing that sort of does not arise, that arises from something which is not a cause and a condition. Therefore, the two main points that the teachings of law of causality or codependent arising stresses is the breaking down of the belief or the refutation of the false belief that things come from nowhere without a cause, without any significant cause. And so the possibility of such is negated. And so in one's own mind, now when we say this, in one's own mind, thinking, as a practitioner, most of you who meditate, do you really have a profound insight into this statement? That things do not happen just because, but that everything happens because of a cause and a condition, that they are not causeless. So that in sort of also involves all the things that you are going through. Fortunate circumstance of having obtained a human birth did not accidentally happen. You created a cause. You worked hard in bringing together all the conducive factors, conditions, that then results into your birth as a human being. Your meeting with the Dharma is also not causeless. It also is dependent upon enormous number of causes and conditions. All, therefore, because of this, all other factors, suffering, pain, different kinds of hindrances in life, did that also happen because of causes and conditions? Yes. causes and conditions are very powerful in that that they are what determines the experiences that we do have experiences of. So in that regard, many people say, for example, in having said so much, people say, well, I know a friend whose child is beautiful, 6-year-old, very beautiful, bright, intelligent child, has cancer, is dying. Was that because this child had a lot of negative karma and therefore because of which? Now, when you put it in so many words, especially when it is over an email or a phone call or a request of an interview or whatever it is, it's never a polite thing to say, yes, the child may have created a tremendous amount of negative karma. So we always end up saying all other kinds of polite answers. Basically, we sort of talk more about collective causes and conditions rather than individual causes and conditions. But having said that, very often in my own mind, I feel we have downplayed karma, we have downplayed causes and conditions. As a meditator, you have to have the courage to know, yes, short life is because of some causes and conditions. It's not that you were chosen to be sort of singled out to have all the misfortunes, but there are. And you have to keep a much more pervasive view of causes and conditions. You can't just blame one single action or one single incident that leads to the fruitioning of any adverse situation. But you have to go through many lifetimes. You have to go through many situations where such a cause may have been created, but the creation of such a cause may not only be intentional, but unintentional causes and negative causes that are created, but which does lead into a summation of a consequent state, which may be such as the cancer that we experience, the short life that we may have, the deceptions and sort of the difficult situations that we may have experienced, material discomfort, or sort of being poverty-stricken, not having friends, being lonely, all of those unfortunate situations, yes. But also all the good things that happen. You're being a human being. You're meeting with the Dharma. You're having devotion. You're having the capacity to have wisdom and compassion. Your ability that each day of your life you can actually do so many wonderful constructive things and you're free to do it. That you have absolute choices. How many sentient beings have such a choice? Those are also arising out of good karma, good causes. And so recognizing that all experiences, situations are coming from somewhere is one of the emphases of the law of causality. In the same way, the second thing that the interdependent origination teachings refute is the second possibility, or the second possibility that it negates, are that things come into being caused by a transcendent designer or a creator, such as a god, for example. It refutes that. Why so is because of just the impossibility of bias and partiality that we can see, where some situations are so favorable, where some situations are so miserable. Any person that we would designate such a wonderful thing as a creator would never be so ignorant simultaneously to have so much favoritism and partiality. That just doesn't make any logical reasoning at all. Therefore, again, these are, however, the two main crucial points that the interdependent origination studies and reflection refute. Having the refutation, now whom are we refuting? Yes, of course, we say, especially in the study of views, we have a lot of view holders of different diverse philosophies that we try to refute. Here, since we are speaking about Mahayana teachings, we are not refuting anyone, we are refuting ourselves. Because that refutation needs to be done in a mind which otherwise does not exercise the essence of refuge. What do we take refuge in? Are often these different factors that Mahayana is trying to refute. We take refuge into believing something more existing and powerful than the law of causality. A person who has a true understanding of the law of causality would then have a very different approach to conducive and adverse situations. a much more flexible attitude that has a pervasive understanding of how things evolve would weaken the rigidity to the approach of any experience that we have. Take, for example, aggravating situations that lead to anger. If a mind truly understood through refuge, it truly understood the wisdom of knowing things as they are, the pervasive view of knowing things, the reality and its nature more truthfully, then you wouldn't pinpoint a certain sort of a blame on just one situation or one person. So since the blame is not so poignantly directed to one situation or one person, the impact of it immediately is diffused. So, you know, there are certain weapons that are created these days. Anti-missile, for example, what are they called? Anti-missiles. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so the sort of activity of such a weapon is whenever a missile is directed somewhere else, it would clash in somewhere in space, diffusing the impact of that particular weapon being directed to cause a lot of destruction. So in the same way, where a much more pervasive view of the reality of phenomena is understood, when the interdependency of all factors of the phenomena are understood, you are immediately generating a much more anti-missile kind of a view that diffuses where the blame is not impactfully given to just a singular incident or a singular person. So kindness is just a natural nature. There is immense kindness, immense pervasive view, immense flexibility and wisdom within such an insight that has to be built. Where such a pervasive view of the interdependent origination is not understood, then the mistaken view is, you are wrong, you gave me the suffering, and then we keep on piling everything. The impact, full impact of the aggression is directed to one situation or one person alone. Therefore, in the understanding of the Dhamma that really engages in being able to defeat self-absorption, a pervasive view of the law of causality, pervasive view of interdependent origination needs to be recognized. Therefore, here again, from the text it says, when all physical objects and material objects can be understood in terms of how many different parts go into composing a wholeness, something whole, how the very idea of wholeness depends on many parts coming together, that mind is then better equipped in understanding and appreciating things as they truly are, rather than how they appear to be, how they are convenient to one's own interpretations, and an interpretation primarily of the ego mind. And so therefore, in the same way, just as physical entities, if we take the consciousness, the mind itself, then being able to see how many, many sort of successive sequences gather together to create a continuum or a wholeness, then we see that there is actually no one single thought, but there are many different things that go into the buildup of even a single thought that allows us to have a much more better idea, better interpretation of how many things gather to create a wholeness or one thing. And so, continuously, so when we talk about understanding interdependent origination, it is by coaching the mind to have this flexible, kinder, pervasive attitude that takes the time to appreciate the parts, the many parts that go into the buildup of one situation. Then some of your parents have been very unkind, and you have, because of an unkindness, left home very early, fell in love with the first possible person you thought you could be independent with, That failed miserably. So you thought, that's the end of trusting a man or a woman. Then you met someone who seemed kind, was a Buddhist. Took you to the first Buddhist seminar. Didn't understand a word of what was being said. But certain word clicked into your mind, so you say. And then, you know, your journey begins. Or you've met with a very kind person. Your parents have been extremely generous. And that generous person died. And because of which you're here. So there's hundreds, each individual story. And that's one of the wonderful things that Jatala particularly likes to do, is to go back to the day you actually became a Buddhist. What made you become a Buddhist? And therefore, these are the many sort of simple things that life presents. Interdependent origination isn't exotic. It's not mysterious. It's not an impossible logic that we have to look at. It's not all about 2 + 2 = 4. But it's the marvels of how 2 can actually become 2 million. Of how things relate, so many causes and conditions come into building up of a situation. Then in this case, whom do we give credit to? And whom do we then give a blame to? Particularly if that is the perspective brought into one's own part of the practices. Then at those moments, especially when you're feeling the anger, when you're feeling the strong emotion, when the very crucial moment of placing the praise or placing the blame comes into being, such a person who has cultivated a pervasive view of interdependent origination coaches one's mind to relax with another thought, an awakened reminder that talks about, well, there is more to this than just what is very apparent. There's much more, many more factors, many more parts to the wholeness of this situation. And so, in the Buddha's teachings, the sutra, he says, when somebody strikes your head, whom do you blame? Do you blame the hand, the stick, the person, the mind, the emotion, the feeling, the perception, or his past experiences and what he has learned from his past experiences? Where do we place the blame? View of not understanding interdependency is where we take the lazy shortcut of immediately finding the most convenient sort of reference to place a blame or a praise. And so we say very easily things like, you are good or you are not good. You are wrong or you are right. This is pure and this is impure. But if a mind were to be coached in understanding how so many different parts, big and small, visible and invisible, direct and indirect, apparent and unapparent, goes into the creation of any situation, anything, any sort of an experience, then here, as it says, one understands that everything that is appearance, that is apparent appearance or an experience, in actuality lack independent or intrinsic existence. No autonomous identity of anything can be posited, because anything and everything is nothing other than a compositeness of many different facts, many different factors. So when that is understood, a much more relaxed attitude towards reality begins to be developed. Sense of a pervasive view where the heightened neurosis of liking something very much disintegrates its power, culminating into something when, what do we see in our great teachers? If you tell them, what do you like? They have no answer. If you tell them, what do you dislike? They have no answer. Narrower the vision of the person, more self-absorbed, they're very clear what you like, what you don't like. Some of you do that when you arrange visits of the teachers. You always say, what does this one like? Now, that's one of the most disrespectful sort of statements or questions to actually answer. Many teachers Of course, those who have now become familiar with living in the West know it's very well meant. But at the same time, that is one of the very difficult answers to give. Because how could you then single out a few things that you like? Because there's a pervasive, relaxed attitude that allows you to live in harmony with whatever situation arises. You embrace it with the same attitude of appreciation. The discrimination of this versus the others is much, much less. Now, however, in the case of the opposite, wherever, as I said, self-absorption and the self-cherishing attitude is very strong, you ask the same question and they're very particular. And some of us, the nuns, we talk about modern-day practitioners' absolute obsession with bed, for example, where you sit. Even if you look at, it's all very sort of interesting to see people traveling, even in aeroplanes sometimes. You know, as it is, the aeroplanes are narrow seat today. You can hardly fit. Then they have their own personal pillows. Then they have a teddy bear along with it. You know, all those toys, the snuggly toys. And so you yourself, the pillow and the snuggly toy. It's very uncomfortable. Three people like that gives you very little space to do anything. So even drinking water becomes a very sort of a, you know, carefully planned out strategy you have to have for that. But what I'm pointing out to is the sort of sense of what is comfortable to you. Very particular. Your particular pillow, your particular mattress, your particular food, your particular way of living, your particular way of practicing. All those particularities become bigger and bigger and bigger. And as they become bigger and bigger and bigger, they will take up a lot of space from the others. And so unaccommodating attitude comes up. How do you think we become unkind? We do not plan to become unkind. Unkindness is just the byproduct of an unaccommodating attitude. How does unaccommodating attitude come up? We don't plan it. But unaccommodating attitude comes up because you need more space for yourself. Self becomes bigger and bigger. Self becomes much more dominant within one's own mind stream. Therefore, that takes up the accommodation. So, therefore, when we talk about consideration for the others, all of the many different Mahayana qualities of kindness, compassion, loving kindness, think of the others. All sentient beings are your mothers. Why does it have to be spelled out in so many ways? It's so that you begin to think that perhaps out of that understanding of the needs and the well-being of the others, you allow lessening of all those things that you need for your own self-cherishing attitude. So it becomes a little bit more accommodating. So that flexibility brings up, brought about by generosity, by loving kindness, by compassion, defeats and reduces the impact and the supremacy of the ego-cherishing attitude, the selfishness. However, to be able to bring that about, sense of the most sort of penetrative wisdom that brings about the loosening of the self-cherishing attitude is the pervasive view of what is done here, is what the teachings itself says. That everything comes into being purely as a result of aggregations of many factors. That things come into being through dependence on others, and each of those lack an independent or an intrinsic existence. Ultimately, there is no autonomous identity. But a beautiful coming together of many different factors, many different paths that leads to the buildup of the same. So when this is understood, this codependency of many factors, the compoundedness, the compositeness of many different factors that go into the buildup of any single situation, emotion, or the creation of any different kind of phenomenal existence or experience. Such is then said to be the knowledge of a person, the view of a person who sees how all things arise dependent upon the other, where there are compositeness. Second part, such a person then sees Dhamma, as it says. One who sees dependent arising sees the Dhamma. In regard to the statement of the Buddha, when he talks about one who sees interdependent origination sees the Dhamma, one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. Therefore, one who sees dependent arising sees the Dhamma, comes into being. Now, when one develops such an understanding of causal dependency, then it allows us to being able to, as we talked about here, a much more deeper, correct experience, correct understanding. And that correct understanding allows us to be at much more ease with whatever arises as feelings, emotions, thoughts in our own mind, the total sort of grasping and the absolute sort of fixation, rigid fixation, becomes more decreased, eventually completely dissolved. Likewise, the outlook towards all external phenomena also goes through a much more gentle approach. A sense of gentle approach, accommodating, patient approach is arises from this. And so here, therefore, one develops, as the text says, one develops the understanding of interdependence of perception and existence, allows one to develop a deeper perspective of the world and greater appreciation for all things that appear, arises within one's own self. So wherever this sense of understanding, sense of naturally resting without the sense, without the complete rigidity, the approach of rigidity, but a much more flexible attitude arises from that, mind eases, mind is able to have a much more state of restfulness. If we look at shamatha and vipassana meditation that we do, we are trying to achieve that. Through shamatha, through vipassana, the analysis is to look at things as they truly are, not as they appear. In the same way, all of the other Mahayana teachings, whether it is cultivating of compassion and patience, whether it is the wisdom approach of seeing the emptiness nature, whether it is through understanding the nature or the relation between appearance and emptiness, all of the approaches are so that the interdependency of all factors that bring about a situation that we see as a whole is further realized, further understood. And therefore, when that is then understood, then the Dhamma seeps into the practice. Your meditation holds Dhamma. Your realization, meditative experiences, holds the Dharma. Where it holds the Dhamma, then the clarity of the intrinsic Buddha mind is unimpededly understood. It is able to manifest within one's own self. And so therefore, here it says, being able to relate to all external phenomenal display, as well as one's own cognitive and mental events, all the feelings, all the emotions, the different kinds of emotional stages that are there, for what it truly is, that a single thought, a single emotion is actually the made-up resultant state of many different causes and conditions, not one to blame, not one to see as independent of the others. Likewise, all appearances, all sounds, all taste, all smell, all textures, all of the different conditions that we are relating to are the consequent made-up sort of situations or perceptible objects that are gathered factors, gathered many, many different kinds of factors. Understanding that brings about liberation. Understanding that brings about the ability to have freedom from one's own ego. And so, all this whole thing about seeing the ego-grasping, self-cherishing attitude as negative. But what is ego? What is self-cherishing attitude? They are nothing but the misunderstanding of what it is. When the misunderstanding is removed through the clearer perspective, clearer recognition of many things that go into the culmination of any thought. Then one begins to see that a lot of those things that we think are hindrances to the path of practices may only be just a mental supposition of it being there. So in the same way, ego, we say, would be a very difficult thing to overcome if it was independent. But the truth of it is that there is no independent ego. It is a history of many different factors. It is the ideas of many different factors. The false concept of it is that we think it is independent and one, singular. But just as we look at all thoughts and all phenomenal displays, if we also look at ego grasping, then it also is not independent. It also is dependent upon so many different factors. When fragmented into its many different parts, we begin to actually see that the basis of ego and the power of the ego can only raise its head again upon our grasping to it as an independent factor. But if one looks at it, if you don't wish to see the concept of the ego as existing, as an independent existing thing, independent of everything, as an alone factor, if that is not the choice that we make, then where is it? Where is ego? In every thought, an ego can be placed. Therefore, it would also be logical to say, in every thought, ego may not be placed. In every sort of interpretation of a situation, ego can be placed. And likewise, in every unfolding situation, one could also not place the ego. That's entirely up to you. But since the misconception of the belief, oh, there is ego, there has to be ego, there is the necessity for the ego to be placed, is an apprehension that we keep making. Therefore, we bring that in addition to everything. It's like adding salt to everything that we eat. Isn't it? We don't like food, most of us. I don't know, some of you may still be. But most of us never eat food as it is without adding something to it. Salt, primarily salt. So it is in the same way. We cannot actually do anything without adding some ego to it. Form cannot be formed without a fair amount of flavoring of ego. Sound cannot be sound without a fair amount of ego flavored in it. So what kind of an ice cream would you like? Ego flavored. What kind of a thought would you project? Ego flavored. So when we are so much into the habit of projecting it in that way, then of course, since the continuum of all the mental events are rampant, unceasing, and so quick that it seems like a seamless continuum, therefore, one major big ego also seems to be there. But if we look carefully at what the nature of the ego is, it isn't there, other than a mental supposition that it must be asserted in everything. There is no one independent ego to be found. And so, if a person thinks, yes, it makes sense, however, to assert the ego in every event, then yes, based upon that assumption of its necessity, that's the habit that we have lived with. But wherever a thorough investigation of seeing how things are not what they are appearing as, but if you really expand the horizon of your own understanding and the perception of internal thoughts as well as external projections of appearances, and see the many different factors that go into the creation of one, particularly in the case of one's own thought. Every thought produced is not a single thought, but a continuum of many different fragments of sensations. Then the sort of speediness of the multiplicity of whatever the mind is conjuring up a single thought gets fragmented into its many different parts. And therefore, there is a state where asserting the ego just doesn't become possible. So the same way when we talk about awareness and mindfulness. Awareness and mindfulness, if you see it as an imposition of another thought over another thought, then that is the forced mindfulness that we are bringing in. That's when you become very sort of aggressively mindful. Don't talk to me, I'm very mindful. Don't disturb me, I'm being very mindful. That kind of mindfulness is the sort of asserting another major thought over an existing appearing thought. But mindfulness, when we are talking about, is a much more sort of a nurturing, gentle approach that is able to have a much more steps backwards to get a better view of things as they are. Where the hurriedness of immediately imposing the ego's demand is left, and you take a step backwards to be able to see things more clearly. When taking a step backwards, you think more clearly, you're more aware of the wholeness of that situation. When that happens, the awareness has the sort of propensity or the possibility, the energy of being able to see all different aspects that go into bringing about even a single thought. Irritation as it arises, such as in your own mind, stepping back mindfully to look at the irritation immediately has to incorporate three things. Yourself, the one conveniently placed as the object of blame, and then the action of the irritation itself. So impact of what you are going to blame immediately has now been diffused into three factors. So the mindfulness is going to then immediately come up with mindfully aware of your own feeling, mindfully aware of where it is being targeted, mindfully of whatever it is that you are experiencing as actions at that moment. So the mindfulness, rather than being very focused at a certain thing, is immediately able to be a pervasive outlook to seeing the situation in its all different situations. So that's why when two people are arguing, third person always has a better perspective. Because you get to see, you step back from whatever is very aggravating, and you are able to see both sides of the story, for example. And very often, it's very easy to be on the third person and say, it doesn't matter, let go. It doesn't occur to the two people who are in the middle of the argument. Why is it so? It's because the perspective of seeing things from all different angles is far more there in the person who has taken a step back. That's what the mindfulness is about, is that the mindfulness of seeing things as all is relevant in that situation allows the mind to have a better understanding of how things are. So the judgment immediately that is given, anger or irritation that immediately produces a judgment, is immediately stepped backwards, that is immediately diffused. And so the quickness with which opinions are expressed, quickness with which how judgments are given, quickness with how you retort, how you immediately return a sarcastic remark with another rude and sarcastic remark, for example, those are all stemmed, those are all impeded when the mindfulness of being able to see things more pervasively comes into being. So here, therefore, it says, whether it is cognitive or mental events, or emotional states, or all appearances of many different phenomena, the physical sort of experiences of the phenomena itself, are all able to be seen more clearly for what it is, really, rather than having a partial view that leads to assumptions and opinions based upon assumptions, which are usually then judgments based upon a false understanding. And therefore, here, according to the teaching, as it says, to be able to really understand the noble truth of cause of suffering, the first suffering and the cause of suffering, first and second truth, thorough investigation and understanding of the third and the fourth noble truth are absolutely important. In order to be able to bring about cessation of unwanted suffering created by ignorance and ignorance of not knowing the true nature of reality, to be able to free oneself from these two situations, thorough investigation and understanding of how things come into production, how things are manifest, how the resultant state arises through the multiple complex coming together of many different factors, must be understood, for which then the Buddha taught the 12 interdependent originations, which then further expand and teaches us the teachings of law of causality. So in brief here, the teachings of the law of causality is given in such a way as an introduction. But then if one goes into further understanding, how can we better understand interdependent origination? Then the sutra where the Buddha taught, Patittasamuttapada, as well as all the subsequent many different kinds of teachings, define them into the understanding of the 12 interdependent originations. 12 steps that gives us an understanding of how things evolve. And therefore, understanding how things evolve, whether they are fraction, moment-to-moment evolution of things, or whether it is a full life cycle, but how 12 factors go into the build-up of any sort of a experience or an encountering, and therefore leads us to a better expansive view of all things that originate, how phenomena originates, how thoughts originate, how you originate, how I originated, how situations originate. And so being able to understand this leads us to a further understanding of the pervasive view, relating to the pervasive view of recognizing causality, codependent origination. Then is the very key factor, as we talked about earlier, where the Madhyamika teachings have said, emptiness leads to compassion. Engaged compassion leads to a refinement of the understanding of emptiness. So in order to bring about that, 12 interdependent originations have been given. Now, in accordance to the, of course, many teachings are there, many different kinds of teachings on the interdependent origination is there. But if you take the explanations, for example, given by Jigme Lingpa, one of the great masters, on what the 12 interdependent origination is, then this evening what I'd like to leave you with to contemplate are the definitions of the 12 interdependent originations, so that you can have that as something to think about when before we go about it tomorrow into the subject. So in accordance to the teachings of Jigme Lingpa in his teachings, he defines, there is a simple definition of the 12 links, first of which is ignorance. And so ignorance is defined here simply as not knowing the true nature of self, not knowing the fundamental nature of reality, ignoring the true nature of phenomena, leading to the projection of things which do not exist, culminating in delusion, leading to confusion. And so, not knowing things as they truly are, believing more what we assume it to be, a hurriedness in the attitude that is deluded, creating confusion, is defined as ignorance. Second interdependent origination is then said to be karmic formation. Karmic formation is defined as the impact of the first, which is ignorance, that leads to creating an impetus or an inclination that causes an inclination that propels us into creating an opinion. Primarily an opinion of liking something, disliking something, or having a very indifferent attitude. Now, because mind is ignorant, because of the immense impact of the karmic formation, of the opinions, an impulse is created. Therefore, the third interdependent origination, often called consciousness, is also defined here as responding to the impulse of the previous opinions. So, what is consciousness? Are the seeds planted in our mind or imprints in our consciousness or in our state of being that propels us into responding familiarly to the different opinions projected by the second interdependent origination, karmic formation? So here, therefore, consciousness is not mind, or consciousness is not a soul, or consciousness is not something, so to speak. Consciousness is just what again Longchenpa often says, which in today's probably modern language could be simply translated as database for all the impulses. And so where the database or the fertile ground where seeds are planted, impulses are planted, it becomes the fertile field for all subsequent information to come, be processed, and again reacted to in familiar ways. Fourth nidana, or fourth interdependent origination, are name and form. Name is another word for all formations or all concepts, all ideas given solidity, form is the resultant state of that solidity or the consequent fruition state of the name. Name refers to feeling, cognition, mental events, and consciousness. And when these feelings, cognition, mental events, and consciousness are active, produces form. Form supports name. Name supports form. Fifth, then, is the sense consciousnesses, or also known as the entrance way for perceptions. Six senses, the fifth nidana, or the fifth interdependent origination, are all the resultant stages of name and form, with a heightened ability of self-expression. Contact is the next, or the sixth interdependent. It means the contact of the faculties, the contact between sense faculty, mind faculty, objects through the link of consciousness. Understanding contact gives us a clear understanding of how contact supports consciousness. And so the enter button that goes to the database, I guess, can be the contact of the sense objects, sense consciousnesses, that re-strengthens the impulse and the impact of the impulse on the consciousness to respond in familiar ways. So all what we talk about as habitual patterns, how can I overcome habitual patterns? So the key or the answer to that is in how contact happens, and if that is then continued, then the familiarity of the information stored in the consciousness strengthens the contact. The contact strengthens the habitual ways of familiar ways of responding to it, and so the habitual patterns never really go through a point of disintegration or cessation. So therefore, because of that, in meditation, sitting in silence breaks contact with familiarity. Sitting still breaks contact with familiarity. Taming the mind in a reference of single-pointed concentration sort of eliminates a lot of the contacts, and it is the most unfamiliar thing that you get used to that reverses the process of familiar patterns such as distraction, dullness, and so on and so forth. So therefore, here, one of the very crucial factors of the 12 Dhyanas is the contact, which, if not stopped, goes into the seventh feeling. Feelings are pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings, indifferent feelings. The crucial link that allows cause for fruitioning of a lot of the causes. And so, feeling enhances subsequently all the subsequent nidanas or the interdependent origination. Feeling enhances and produces the earth, which is craving. It then goes into producing, grasping, the ninth. Craving is defined as involvement, so deep an involvement that only the experience of that involvement matters more than anything else. That is craving. So in the text it says, when an elephant knows that if it steps into a mud hole, that the quagmire can be so dangerous that it could drown without coming out. But so caught in the experience of the soothing feeling that the cool mud has on his skin, it knowingly enters into the mud hole and drowns. Same way, craving. You know it's bad for you, but you do it nevertheless. One more time. From Monday onwards, you're not going to do it. From next year, you're not going to do it. From the next retreat, you're not going to do it. This time, still the same craving comes out. Like any addiction, craving. When the involvement of the craving of either wanting something or avoiding something becomes a madness, when the involvement of it, getting something and not getting something, becomes so heightened that it leads to a point of madness, that's called grasping, the ninth nidana. Tenth nidana is called becoming. That is when one is actually acting upon whatever it is that you have desperately felt it was important to you. When the madness of the grasping becomes so strong that you act upon it, it is called becoming. Becoming leads to the 11th link, which is birth or rebirth. A full manifestation of experience combined together with an empowering possibility to creating more is then birth. So it's the beautiful place where both things blend. The causal karma, fruitions, and upon the same basis, more causes are created for future. Therefore, although many times the 11th interdependent origination referred to as birth, the proper term for it is actually rebirth. So there is the becoming, and then the birth process of it is immediately that very powerful state where there is the power immediately to creating some more happens, which then leads to the 12th interdependent origination, aging and death. Jimmy Limba describes it as main forms of suffering. Various kinds of suffering, difficulties and pain, things that are unpleasant, burdensome, happinesses not obtained, wanting to obtain, suffering not wanting to obtain, but being obtained, happiness wanting to obtain, but not being obtained. This is then all the experiences known as aging and death. Of course, in its very plain and simple interpretation, there is birth, which leads to a gradual impermanent state, which is called the changeability, which is aging, and then the process of death. But here, in speaking about momentary 12 interdependent origination, then it is the manifestation of that process. And so aging is a point where you have worked hard for all the 11th different forms. You've really given appearance. You've really created a situation out of the craving, out of the grasping, out of the wanting, out of the familiarity of your mind. And so when you create that situation, things happen your way. There is more craving, there is more grasping, there is suffering involved in it. Things do not go your way, there is more abject suffering, and therefore the full manifestation of the other 10 or the 11 interdependent links creates the process of aging. There is the death process where that situation ends to producing and continuing again with more of the manifestations. So the 12 interdependent links in terms of its sort of general enumeration are these 12. Many of you are familiar with the subject of 12 interdependent origination. But here, what is very crucial for you to contemplate upon this evening is not only the enumeration of the 12 interdependent origination. For those for whom it is new, still reflect upon the defined definitions or become familiar with the enumeration, the list of these 12 names. But for those who have heard this before, is not only about these 12 aspects, but taking the 12 Nidanas to beginning to see them more in the context of interdependent, codependent arising, Pratitya Samudapada. How all different factors go into the creation of every situation. Here what you are trying to learn to understand is all the parts that go into building up the whole, rather than the misconception that we believe or we sort of live by, where we take the whole and discredit the parts. And so being able to really expand your mind into understanding the enormity and the beautiful coming together of all compoundedness, of all different factors, that then is the only way, as the Mahayana teachings say, that eases the mind into a state of contentment and relaxation, where contentment and relaxation with things as they arise comes about, then there is no need to be something else kind or to cultivate another kind of kindness. Mind that is able to appreciate the beauty of everything that comes into being, comes into gathering as an experience or as an appearance, is nothing but a genuinely kind mind, genuinely patient mind. That natural sort of a good relationship with things as they arise, and the patience and the kindness that arises, is the bodhicitta explained in the context of emptiness, compassion, compassion, emptiness. Until then, it is very much still in the realm of work, realm of doing something, realm of something to obtain, realm of still being very, very sort of subject to the domination of one's own ego and hope and fear. And therefore, it could be, by all its appearance, kindness, but yet there could always be a secret agenda of that kindness where one wants to take some credit, be part of some sort of gaining something out of that kindness. For one to embody nothing but kindness, the key factor to that is the disintegration of the ego's supreme belief that what it sees is what it is. But rather to have a notion of being able to see what things really are, and therefore being able to appreciate that factor, which is then called cultivating right view. Where the right view is there, then subsequently all the different correct ways of approaching, whether it is the 37 practices, whether it is the Eightfold Path, become much more natural, much more your own being, rather than a path to practice, rather than something to follow as a dictum or a doctrine or a philosophy. And so, and when that conviction, when the confidence of that right view arises in one's own mind, there is never a moment where one doesn't take refuge. Refuge is always steadfast. And the refuge is much more pure in that it is taking refuge in the absolute truth, things as they truly are. And that conviction or the confidence of the truth remains unshaken, immovable, strengthened, sort of surrender, strengthened taking refuge into that kind of an absolute truth is what is then called being a Buddhist, becoming a Buddhist.